The programme which follows is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM.
You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. On today's programme, which continues a month of episodes looking at Australasian comics, I'm talking to a pair of cartoonists who use fantastical creatures on the page to tell very different kinds of stories. Later in the show, I'm talking to graphic novelist Nikki Greenberg about her adaptation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, recast as a phantasmagorial collection of creatures from both mythology and the animal kingdom, partying together on the east coast of America. Greenberg has also done an experimental version of Hamlet as a graphic novel, and various strips on her website and in small press titles that vary from autobiography to the perils of adopting a small zombie in the attic. Before that, I'm talking to New Zealander Richard Fairgrey about his dinosaur procedural police mashup comic Blastosaurus. The interview was recorded at the London Film and Comic Con, so you'll have to forgive the background noise.
Is this your first London con, or is this something you do regularly, trying to find an audience both sides of the globe?
This is my first London con. I spend about 20% of my life at conventions just in New Zealand and Australia, though. So I figured, why not travel a bit further for once?
What's the New Zealand scene like? I mean, there are a few New Zealand-based creators that we know of in this country, but presumably it's just like the tip of the iceberg.
The New Zealand scene is varied. There are a lot of creators, but unfortunately not a lot of content coming out. Square Planet, my company, we're actually the largest comic producers. We put out about 25 books a year, and most of which we put out online for free. We do daily comic strips and things like that, but it's a very small indie scene with there's very little chance to break into the mainstream because there are only four or five comic shops left in the country.
Wow, okay. And there aren't any sort of homegrown newsstand comics like the massive range that we have in the UK?
No, there's nothing like that. I mean, we've actually had quite a spate of graphic novels coming out recently. Ant Sang's book, Shaolin Burning. Chris Slane did a book called Nice Day for a War, which is a sort of mixture between a history book and a comic. Kimball Bent Malcontent by Chris Gross, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name, so I apologize. But there's not a lot coming out in terms of actual monthly regular comics. And Blastosaurus was actually the first ever monthly comic in New Zealand.
Wow. You say that there are only four comic shops left in the whole country. Obviously, that's not enough to support the kind of work that you guys are doing. Does that mean you stock it in regular bookshops as well and newsagents?
Yeah, we don't really have newsagents as such. Blastosaurus, we just got a distribution deal for Blastosaurus through all of the bookstores. There might be more than four comic shops, but it's not much. There are two in Auckland, Heroes for Sale and Gotham Comics, which are good, and then there's maybe two or three others. Of course, with the Christchurch earthquake, we lost one. So,
oh my god!
Yeah, it's a grim scene for the pamphlet style comic. Mm.
And I guess that means if a creator does come along, that America senses could be exploited, for want of a better word, the likes of Roger Landridge and Dylan Horrocks, then they probably end up working for companies like Marvel and DC.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the cream rises to the top. I mean, Roger Langridge and Dylan Horrocks are incredibly talented people, but the reality is people don't see the kind of talent that there is in New Zealand because we are, even in the digital age, we're still right on the other side of the world, putting out books at conventions, you know, that are only seen by other New Zealanders. Mm. So it's hard. And I mean, it's hard for anyone to break into the American industry, let alone someone saying, hey, I'm from the other side of the world. I can't meet you face to face. Please look at my email.
Yeah. The comic that you're promoting most, I guess, at this con is the hardback collection of Blastosaurus. That was previously serialized as individual comics?
Yeah, we published Blastosaurus as a monthly series for a year and a half in New Zealand. Before we decided to start releasing it online and in collected volumes, because I just think there's more of a market for graphic novels than there is for individual issues.
And We were talking before I turned the microphone on, and you said that obviously the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were a large influence on this, because I guess this is an adult gun-packing dinosaur in a fedora.
Well, you know, I was raised in Ninja Turtles. It was a huge influence on me. But even as a kid, I couldn't suspend my disbelief. You know, I would watch it and I'd think, well, why is it they can put on a hat and a coat and no one can see their turtle faces anymore? That's not a costume. Mm. So I've always wanted to create something that subverted that genre. So Blastosaurus is a 6-foot-tall mutant Triceratops cop who is mostly relegated to publicity stunts, and most people don't even believe he exists. They think he's just some guy in a suit. He tries to point out to them that it's just a coat and pants, but, you know, it's a tough life.
And you co-write and draw the comic. How does the work break down in terms of you and the other writer?
We literally write everything together. I mean, sitting in the same room across the table from each other, talking through the dialogue and the action, and the two of us typing it out at whatever speed we can. And then I go home and draw for 10 hours a day. Lots of fun.
An aspect of the comic that seems to be very important, just flicking through it, is the colour scheme. You have very sort of subtle palettes from one sort of section to the next, which I guess delineate not only the mood but the sort of scene changes that you get through an ongoing narrative.
Yeah, my wife's actually the colourist on it. She literally taught herself to be a colourist 2 years ago and is now phenomenally good. Because the first story arc is an origin of a dinosaur being mutated, there's a lot of jumping between the past, present, and future. Mm. So we wanted to have a specific colour palette for each one, just as... I mean, it's a subtle change, but it's enough to let the reader know where they are without having to put a big subtitle that says, "Hey, you're in the future now!"
And in terms of the layout of each page, you seem to have quite a formalist approach to the panel borders. Does that come from being, I guess, a fan of 70s and 80s comics, things like, you know, the work of Dave Gibbons?
It comes from being a fan of 50s and 60s comics, okay. Actually. I didn't read my first comic until I was 16, and in that sense, yes, it was my co-writer Terry Jones giving me lots of, you know, the best Alan Moore stuff from the 80s to read, but very quickly I moved straight into Silver Age Superman. But also, because Blastosaurus is at its heart a procedural cop drama, I kind of feel like a formal panel layout helps to reinforce that style.
And as a comic that you're trying to launch as a hardback as well as something that's serialized, the package is very appealing. It's got a cover by Derek Robertson. It's got a back page illustration that's kind of a homage to Love and Rockets. And also you've got pinups by the likes of Mike Allred inside. How do you go about getting other creators interested in your work and contributing to it so that you can promote it as something that may be new to a lot of readers?
It's purely good luck. I mean, Derek and I have been friends for quite a few years now, and we've been looking for projects to work together on for ages. And so when I said I was doing a nice fancy collection of Blastosaurus, he wanted to do a cover for it. Mike Allred did the pinup actually years ago for a different release of it that was meant to come out through America and didn't, which I'm not going to go into. But we've been sitting on that for 4 years waiting for a place to put it. So, with this book, it actually came down to a matter of we can't fit all the pinups we have. We've actually got a whole slew of them backed up for the next volume, which is quite a nice place to be, really.
And you said that you give out quite a lot of your comics free on the internet. Does that mean that you have an international following for your titles, or is it still actually quite local?
It's surprisingly international. About 90% of our web traffic is from the UK and the US. It's strange. I do, you know, a lot of conventions in New Zealand. We sell really well at the conventions in New Zealand, but for the most part, the people who are buying the book there will queue up to buy whatever new book we have out, and then I'll say, "Are you reading it online?" And they'll look at me with a look of utter confusion and say, "Oh, it's online as well." And, "Yes, it is. Please visit my website. Buy things there. Don't make me carry things to conventions."
Like you said, it's probably quite difficult living in New Zealand, having connections on this side of the world where you're not meeting face-to-face. In terms of stockists for your book, have you approached many of the UK comic shops in order to kind of increase your market sale?
Not yet, but I only landed this morning. I'm here for a few days after the show, so I'm going to be going around to some comic shops, and I'm meeting with a few distribution agencies to see if they're interested. We actually have a soft cover edition of the book, which we're trying to get into shops all around the world. It's all over New Zealand and Australia, so we're just hoping to get into the UK market and then, you know, pull a little bighorn gambit and surround America and then crush them.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
The Blastosaurus webcomic and information about how to buy the various print incarnations can be found at squareplanetcomics.com, where such titles as Roddy's Film Companion, Ricky and Lyle, I Fight Crime, Ghost Ghost, and various other strips can be found on a regular basis. Square Planet Comics are also on Facebook and Tumblr, and you can also find Richard Fairgray using his @Blastosaurus handle on Twitter. Next, here's my interview with Nikki Greenberg, talking about her graphic novel adaptations of Hamlet and The Great Gatsby, and various small press and web comics about romance, autobiography, and zombies. So I guess you're best known for your graphic novel adaptation of The Great Gatsby, which I guess you finished about 10 years ago. How long had you been working in comics at that point?
I'd been drawing comics since I was about 17.
Wow.
And I started Gatsby when I was 25. And it was an enormous project. It took 6 years, but, you know, I was working full-time. And I actually did a few other books at the same time, so it was a long trip.
You hadn't quite hit the age of 30 that the narrator of Gatsby starts to feel worried that he hasn't achieved anything with his life.
No, and I'm trying to think. It must have come out around the time I was a little over 30 when it came out.
I mean, it's funny, I say that it's the book that you're best known for, but it actually says on the rear of the on the rear cover, for copyright reasons, this book is not for sale in the USA or UK. But that said, I found it in Waterstones in Brighton, so I guess copies did find it to this part of the world.
Well, I'm not quite sure how this works, but it is now out of copyright in the UK, the original.
Oh.
So I'm not sure when you found it, but the original is now out of copyright.
Oh, well, I wonder if that was causing the problem.
Oh. I'm not sure. It's still in copyright in the US, the original.
Ah, interesting. So having done various small press comics, I guess you'd already been contributing to Tango at that point?
I had, yeah. You've seen Tango over there?
No, but I found there were some strips on your website, including Never Go to Bed Angry.
Right.
Which was reproduced in Tango.
Okay, Tango is quite a Melbourne institution. It's a really wonderful anthology that went for about 12 years, published by the wonderful Bernard Callio. So that's something that many, many Australian comic artists have had contact with, Tango.
Because I guess the first time I came across your name was they showed a documentary called Comics Melbourne at the Australasian Literature Festival in London last year. You were in it, Paul Gravett was in it, Bruce Mutard and others. So presumably Melbourne is kind of a thriving hub for the Australian comics community.
Yeah, very much so. And there's been a really strong comics scene here for years. It's very supportive, it's very diverse, it's fantastic.
And I guess a publication like Tango shows the wide variety of different styles that are out there at the moment.
Very much so. I mean, Tango, the last Tango was some years ago now, and I would say the independent comics scene here just continues to go from strength to strength.
Strips like Never Go to Bed Angry, were those the kind of stories that you were doing in general? Because I read that Tango was a romance-orientated anthology, and yet this is a story about a little zombie in the attic.
Yes. The romance was, I think, interpreted very broadly in Tango, and it was more in the sort of general romantic sense rather than romantic love.
Okay.
Yes, so it was very flexible. But yes, that was about the couple who have the romantic notion, well, the man of the couple who has the romantic notions about raising this little zombie who, of course, turns on them and eats them.
Mm. Well, I read a few of your zombie comics online and they all seem to have the same punchline, but it's still funny every time.
Yes. I enjoyed those immensely.
I mean, I suppose if you wanted to read too much into it, the zombie in the comic could represent any kind of life-changing experience that a couple has that overwhelms them.
Yes. I mean, I thought the zombies sort of play different roles in each of the comics, but I saw them a little bit as outsiders who sort of took their revenge on a world that misunderstood them.
Mm. And obviously you're enough of a fan of a genre that in that comic as well, the little zombie sleeps in a box marked Romero shoes.
Yes. I'm so glad you picked that up.
All of the strips on your website seem to be in a similar style, but then I guess you change that when you do long projects like Gatsby or Hamlet.
Yeah, very much so. And I feel like, you know, I'm now working in children's picture books.
Mm.
And even there, every book, the style changes, sometimes quite dramatically. And, I feel like I'm learning with every project. And the style definitely has to suit the, you know, has to suit the work.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, it's a constant surprise finding the style that fits. And often it sort of comes about by, a lot of scribbling, but also a bit of happy accident.
Mm.
But I did work in that kind of pen and ink, wobbly line zombie style for quite a long time.
Mm. And then I guess when we reached the turn of the century, you felt like tackling an epic adaptation like Gatsby. How did that come about?
Well, I was very passionate about the novel, and I had in my mind that I'd like to do a long graphic novel because I'd done short comics, maybe up to about 15 pages before that, and you know, this was an idea that sort of developed probably when I was overseas living in Spain for a year, and thought about it, and when I got back, I started to explore it, and became completely passionately wrapped up in the project.
Hmm. It's really interesting the way that you've interpreted the characters. I've not read the novel itself, but does Fitzgerald basically abstain from describing what they look like?
Yeah, very much so. And it's such a sort of shimmering, vivid novel, but also quite elusive. And when you think about it, you feel these characters' personalities enormously. But you have almost no description of what they look like beyond a little bit of the kind of size of their bodies or the bearing of their bodies. We don't even know what colour Daisy's hair is, although in movies they tend to make her blonde.
So I suppose casting Gatsby himself as a seahorse came from perhaps the way that the animal moves itself, shimmering through water and being hard to get hold of.
Yeah, that's it. A kind of enigmatic quality, but also there's something about Gatsby that is very gorgeous, but also a little bit preposterous. You know, he has concocted this character out of his 17-year-old fantasy, and the result is it's beautiful, but it's also a little bit ridiculous.
Mm.
And the seahorse just seemed to work for that.
And I guess the theme of the novel is about how these wonderful individuals from the West have invaded the East. The way they act, the way they dressed is so alien to the locals that I guess casting them as various creatures, whether mythological or real, works in that kind of narrative.
They're certainly larger than life characters. And I remember reading the novel for the first time when I was 17 and when I studied it at school. And they felt immense and fascinating, and like they belonged to a world that I could only hope to have a little glimpse at, which is a little bit how Nick Carraway encounters them. And you know, that changed with each reading, but they are larger than life characters. They drawing them as humans, I think, would probably have reduced Fitzgerald's characters rather than trying to live up to them. So drawing them as these kind of crazy, strange creatures felt more like the way to pay tribute.
Mm. And then in amongst the lizards and squids and seahorses, you depict Tom Buchanan as a troll-like character that seems to be influenced by Fungus the Bogeyman.
Yes, very much so. And although he doesn't have funguses sort of sweet nature. the original drawings of Tom are actually far more grotesque. My original sketchbook pictures, I have him kind of very hairy and bursting out of these riding boots and bending a riding crop until it almost breaks and looking really quite terrifying. And I had to tone it down for the final book because he came across looking like something that lives in the sewers, rather than as a multi-millionaire polo-playing man with a lot of social clout. So I did have to actually pull it back a bit.
There's a short autobiographical comic on your website about how when you finished Gatsby, you were still full of the enthusiasm to tackle another epic project. So you did Hamlet afterwards. I mean, presumably you were getting enough positive feedback on Gatsby that you thought, well, let's go for the most famous work of English literature next.
Yes. Well, look, I was on a high, and doing Gatsby was just such a fantastic experience, and having it published was a fantastic experience, and it all went very well. And I'd been with this book for such a long time, for 6 years, that not having it in my life was an enormous hole. There was this Gatsby-shaped vacuum that had to be filled. And what was big enough to fill it but Hamlet? And that was a thrilling work to engage with, because of course it's the most famous play in the English language, and it's that this monumental beast, that it was fascinating.
Well, and it's interesting that, like I said, you changed your style for each of these projects, and Hamlet, as well as depicting the characters in this kind of ink blotty way, the backgrounds seem to be a mixture of painting and collage, as if there are so many kaleidoscopic adaptations of Hamlet that people have encountered over the years. The only way you can approach it as an artist is as a kind of combination of many different sources.
Yeah, well, that's a really lovely way of bringing it together, actually. I did feel quite compelled to make it surreal, and probably partly for the reasons that you've just described. My original idea about the backgrounds was I wanted to have that kind of oppressive sense of Piranesi's imaginary prisons, fanciful prisons. And I looked at a lot of those pictures ultimately decided I had to go away from that idea because it would have been all too dark with the inkblot characters. They really had to be very bright backgrounds so that the inkblots worked against them or worked in front of them. And so in the end, it was a bit of a combination of Gaudi's tile work and forms and the colours of things like Tiffany glass that kind of inspired those backgrounds. And then, of course, the collage, which are the backstage backgrounds, they really drew on that kind of sense of oddities and bits and bobs that would be backstage to make the props and to make the sets.
Well, and also, I guess, after doing Gatsby and using half of Australia's ink supply, that maybe you felt slightly guilty.
We've got a fair bit of ink in Australia.
Cool.
No, there was a lot of ink. That's true.
in each case, how much did you have to compress the original text in order to fit it into a graphic novel?
I was able to treat the texts very differently just because of the different nature of the forms novel as opposed to a play. Dealing with the text of a novel was much trickier because I don't know what percentage of Fitzgerald's text I used, but I necessarily only used quite a small proportion of it. There were things that I drew rather than using his words. And I really had to think about where I wanted to showcase his prose or where I could sort of summarise, I suppose, in pictures, and how to have the prose playing and the pictures playing off one another. So that was a really delicate process and definitely didn't come close to using the text verbatim. Though, you know, I tried not to meddle with the text. For Hamlet, I've got about 90% of the sort of generally accepted composite text. So it really is the 4-hour version of the play. with some cuts, and the cuts were really there for pacing purposes, pacing on the page, which obviously works differently to pacing on a stage, on a real stage with real sound and real movement. And one of the tricky things there was actually just fitting the really large amount of text into the speech bubbles and making that work within the panels and within the page compositions. So there were very different challenges for the two types of adaptation.
And I guess as well, something like Hamlet, where the lead character and indeed some of the other characters like Ophelia are sort of trapped in some sort of doomed fate because of their surroundings. The nature of comics, where you're always aware of the future because you can see all the other panels on the page, all the other panels on the opposite page, where the future is kind of there at the same time as the present. That makes comics an ideal medium for adapting something like Hamlet, where your fate is concurrent with your present.
That is a really cool observation. I really like that. I feel like I should steal that.
Be my guest.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I'm fascinated by in comics is that ability to be in more than one moment in space and time at once. And I definitely play with that a lot in Hamlet with the black space around the frames intruding into the frames and being in different dimensions at the same time. But, wow, the idea that that the fate is already written and you can see a little bit of it ahead, that's very cool.
Conversely, having done these two weighty adaptations of Gatsby and Hamlet, on your website there are shorter adaptations of Melville's Moby Dick and To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvel. I guess those are more of an amused boof that you could do this short, whimsical adaptation, both of which are very domestic. Moby Dick is just the musings of a guy sitting in his bath, while To His Coy Mistress is a guy like cooking an egg.
Yes, definitely on a smaller scale than Hamlet. Though the Moby Dick one was something that I did when I was just at the beginning of working as a junior lawyer. And I felt quite constrained, quite trapped by this this job and this thing of turning up in a suit each day, and so my reading of Moby Dick, which I was reading at the time, was of this kind of attempting to escape out to sea, and that's where that comic came from. But yes, very very much from the small domestic sphere.
How much do you divide your time between your day job as a lawyer and doing comics? Does one pay the bills and the other provide an artistic distraction?
It was definitely the case for years that that I was lawyering to subsidise my passion, what I really loved doing, which was these books. But since our little daughters were born, my job has been divided between the home front and doing my books. So it's been a lovely balance, actually. I haven't been lawyering for the last 6 years.
Okay. I read that you were recently included in an exhibition about Jewish artists. How important is that as part of your identity as a creator?
I think that was some of my Hamlet work was included in an exhibition of comic artists generally at the Jewish Museum.
Oh, okay.
Which was, that was lovely. It was very nice to be asked. It's hard to say how much that has influenced my work. But it was lovely to be included in that exhibition.
In recent years, you've been doing more children's picture books than comics. What sort of sequential traditions have you brought to the children's books?
Spending so much time doing comics has definitely influenced the way I design picture books, I'm sure. But I'm looking at one that I'm working on at the moment, and it's about a bunch of meerkats, and it's written entirely in dialogue, so there's no narrative over the top. Well, of course, it's sequential, not getting too abstract, but I think that the probably pacing and transitions I think you learn a lot about that doing comics.
Mm.
And that's a great help in doing picture books.
Well, and also, I guess, I mean, I've got a printout of To His Coy Mistress in front of me, and it occurred to me that if you blew up each individual panel to the size of a page, it would work equally well as a picture book as it would a comic. So I guess there is that crossover between the two media.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that there is not a clear dividing line between the two at all. And it's, you know, it's for purposes of marketing or the age of the audience that that we even draw a distinction. There's obviously plenty of works that it's hard to say, well, is this a picture book or is this a comic? All part of the one family.
Yeah, well, someone like Raymond Briggs was doing graphic novels long before everyone else, but they were labelled as picture books because they were in the children's section.
Sure, exactly.
So might we expect more traditional comics and graphic novels from you going forward?
It's very hard to say. I think it's very hard to predict what will pop out in the future. At the moment, I'm very much immersed in picture books and also starting to move into junior novels. So I don't know. I don't know what will come next.
But in the meantime, we can enjoy your two adaptations and the various strips that are on your website.
Yes, I hope so.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Alex.
No worries.
You can find more information about Nikki Greenberg's work by going to nikkigreenberg.com. That's nikkigreenberg.com. Nikki Greenberg's adaptation of Hamlet can be found in all good bookshops. However, only Waterstones in the UK seems to have figured out that The Great Gatsby is out of copyright, and so it's the only place you'll probably be able to find her adaptation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic in the UK. Nikki's website also includes a variety of her webcomics, the aforementioned zombie romance Never Go to Bed Angry, and her short adaptations of Moby Dick and To His Coy Mistress. On the subject of webcomics, the excellent comic reading app Sequential for iPad is currently holding a summer sale, with between 50 and 90% off some of its digital graphic novel downloads. This includes over 70% off The Tale of One Bad Rat by Brian Talbot, 75% off Mind Management by Matt Kint, Fagin by Will Eisner, and the classic European anthropomorphic title Black Sad, as well as many others. The summer sale includes titles from Dark Horse, Fantagraphics, Myriad, Self-Made Hero, and many more, and the application is available from the iTunes App Store. Back in the real world, there are various comic book events taking place in London over the next few weeks. At Gosh Comics, 1 Berwick Street, Soho, they have a signing and talk by Charlie Adlard, long-running artist of the Walking Dead comic, who'll be in the store on Saturday, July the 18th, signing between 1 and 3pm, and then talking about his work from 7. The following week, Wednesday the 22nd of July, Matt Taylor and Tom Muller will be in the shop signing the first issue of their new experimental image comic, Wolf. And then towards the end of the month, there's the second of Gosh and Broken Frontier's new Drink and Draw events, where artists Danny Noble, David Hine, and Mark Stafford will be encouraging fans of drinking and drawing to meet at Gosh Comics at 6:30pm, where they'll be moving on to the Phoenix Arts Club on Charing Cross Road for 7. You can find more information about all Gosh events by going to goshlondon.com. Taking place across London from the 11th to the 26th of July is the Shoeback Festival, celebrating contemporary Arab arts and culture, as well as events covering contemporary Arab satire, puppetry, digital arts, dance and other media. Paul Gravett will be hosting a panel discussion about comics in the Arab world at the British Library, 96 Euston Road, on July the 26th, from 11am till noon. Guests include Asia Alfazi, Lena Marej, and Andel, discussing the latest examples of sequential art. Alongside this comics event at the British Library, there are also examples of Gulf Street art at various locations, including South Bank Undercroft, Stockwell Legal Wall, and Leek Street Studios. You can find more information about all Shoeback events by going to shoeback.co.uk. That's shoeback.co.uk.
Thinking further ahead, an expensive but very rewarding course on the creation of comics is taking place at the Arvon Centre in Devon. This year's text and image course takes place between the 12th and 17th of October, with tutors this year including Hannah Berry, author of Adam Tyne and Britain and Brew Lightly, and Simone Lear, author of Fluffy and Please God Find Me a Husband. Guardian cartoonist Stephen Collins, author of The Gigantic Beard That Was Evil, will also be in attendance, and the Arvon Text and Image course is a renowned and intensive 6-day learning experience which is ideal for anyone wanting to break into the comics industry or further their craft. You can find more information about the course by going to arvon.org/course/text-image.
Panel Borders was recorded, edited and introduced by Alex Fitch, is a Panel Borders production, and you can find all previous episodes on our blog www.panelborders.wordpress.com, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.
This program was brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. Visit our website at resonancefm.com to hear our vast range of original 24/7 broadcasts. Resonance is a not-for-profit broadcast platform and relies on public support. If you like what you've heard, make a secure donation at resonancefm.com.